half Europe free when otherwise it would be in chains. And look at us now. 44% of the voters agreed with her, enough to give the Conservatives 339 seats to Labour's 269. Margaret Thatcher was going to be the United Kingdom's first female prime minister. Approximately 2 months later, President Jimmy Carter gave what came to be known as his malaise speech. He spoke about a crisis of confidence in America, particularly with regards to rising energy costs and decreasing gasoline availability. His solution was to raise taxes on energy producers and to limit gasoline imports, as well as to encourage people to use less electricity. He asked citizens to take no unnecessary trips, to use carpools or public transportation whenever you can, to park your car one extra day per week, to obey the speed limit, and to set your thermostats to save fuel. Living a colder life, literally so, would be a way to turn shortages into a surplus. Every act of energy conservation like this is more than just common sense, he insisted. I tell you, it is an act of patriotism. Asking the public to solve an energy crisis by using less energy was akin to solving food shortages by eating less. It made sense on one level, but missed the broader point entirely. The GOP now saw a golden opportunity to recapture the White House, but many in the party establishment were terrified that Reagan would be a disaster of a candidate. The 1964 Goldwater catastrophe was fresh in Republican minds. If Goldwater could only carry six states, Reagan didn't seem to be able to do much better. He was too extreme, and now even older than he had been when he was already too old in 1976. Polling in January of 1980 had Reagan losing to Carter 33% to 62%, an even bigger landslide than Goldwater's final result. Iowa was the first state for Republican voters to weigh in on their choice for the party's nominee, and the relatively obscure George H.W. Bush managed to pull ahead of Reagan to take the win. Bush had most recently served as director of the CIA for a year, previously having been head of the RNC, ambassador to the UN, and a two-term member of Congress, none of which were great stepping stones to the White House. This was a Stop Reagan campaign, pure and simple, and Bush was quick to position himself as the frontrunner after taking Iowa. Now they'll be after me, howling and yowling at my heels. What we will have is momentum. We look forward to Big Mo being on our side. Bush pulling out a win in the New Hampshire primary would put Reagan in major trouble. In an effort to avoid Federal Election Commission guidelines, Reagan's campaign sponsored a debate to be hosted by a local newspaper. He then invited all the other Republican candidates, while Bush was under the impression that the debate would just be between the two of them. An argument erupted on stage, with moderator John Breen finally asking the sound man to turn Reagan's mic off. In one of the few moments when Reagan lost his cool, he turned to the man and snapped, "I am paying for this microphone, Mr. Green." Reagan got the man's name wrong, but that mattered little. The other candidates all applauded him from the stage, and the audience erupted into enormous cheers at Reagan putting a journalist in his place. From then on, it was a straightforward path for Reagan to get the nomination. Sensing an opportunity, liberal Republican Congressman John Anderson announced that he would be running for president as an independent. His hope was to form a coalition drawing from those who thought Carter was too inept, but Reagan too conservative. Less than 2 months before Election Day, the organization sponsoring the presidential debates determined that Anderson was polling well enough to invite him to debate both Carter and Reagan. President Carter refused, no doubt calculating that validating Anderson's candidacy would only hurt his own chances on net. Reagan went ahead and debated Anderson regardless and did well for himself. Reagan eventually acceded to Carter's demands to debate the president one-on-one. In retrospect, President Carter did not seem to know what he was getting himself into. During the debate, he came off as peevish and miserable, while Reagan stood there in full Hollywood mode and appeared to handle the questions effortlessly. Rather than coming off as a far-right madman who would get the United States into nuclear war, Reagan seemed reasonable and qualified. His home run moment was when Carter criticized Reagan for having previously been against Medicare. Reagan smiled and calmly said, "There you go again," as politely as possible, calling the President of the United States a liar to his face in front of a captive national audience. He ended the debate with a very simple question to the voters. "Next Tuesday, all of you will go to the polls. We'll stand there in the polling place and make a decision. I think when you make that decision, it might be well if you would ask yourself, are you better off than you were 4 years ago?" When the election results came in, it was Goldwater in 1964 all over again, only this time it was the incumbent president cast as the electoral loser. In addition to Washington, D.C., and just as Goldwater had, Jimmy Carter only took six states. Reagan was elected in a landslide, with his coattails ushering in a Republican Senate for the first time since Eisenhower. As 1981 began, what had been considered an absurdity 5 years prior became a reality in both the United States and the UK. Both governments were now under the control of members of the right-wing half of each nation's respective right-wing party. That same year, British group Fun Boy 3 wrote a hit single expressing the views of many individuals in the halls of power about this unprecedented situation. It was entitled, "The Lunatics Have Taken Over the Asylum." Chapter 12, And You Know It. Starting in 1840, every U.S. president elected in a year divisible by 20 had died in office. It started with William Henry Harrison, elected in 1840 and dead within a month of his inauguration. Abraham Lincoln, 1860, was next with the first presidential assassination, followed by the murders of 1880's James A. Garfield and 1900's William McKinley. Both Warren Harding, 1920, and FDR, 1940, died of natural causes while in office, but JFK, 1960, was not so lucky. Reagan, 1980, was next in the rotation, and 10 weeks after he became president, almost continued the pattern. On March 30, 1981, a gunman named John Hinckley Jr. managed to shoot President Reagan, his press secretary, a Secret Service agent, and a police officer before being apprehended. Hinckley was motivated by a deranged attempt to impress teen actress Jodie Foster, who was completely disturbed when she learned about his actions. The president was quickly shoved into a waiting limousine, and one of his agents immediately covered him as a human shield. Reagan began to spit up blood, leading both him and the agent to think that the president had been shoved so hard that he had broken a rib. The decision was swiftly made to reroute the limo from the White House to a nearby hospital. Reagan insisted on walking into the hospital to demonstrate to Americans that all was well, but swiftly collapsed once inside. It was when the medical team started examining Reagan that they realized the president had been shot. A distraught Nancy arrived as Reagan was being prepped for surgery. "Honey," he told her, "I forgot to duck." His nonstop wisecracking must have been simultaneously reassuring and maddening, scribbling down W.C. Fields' quip to his nurse that, "All in all, I'd rather be in Philadelphia." Once in the operating room, Reagan took a second to remove his oxygen mask and tell the assembled surgical team that, "I hope you're all Republicans." "We're all Republicans today," replied the Democrat surgeon. The year 1981 was a difficult one for Margaret Thatcher as well. When she had first entered the Prime Minister's residence at No. 10 Downing Street in 1979, Thatcher said that, "I would just like to remember some words of St. Francis of Assisi, which I think are really just particularly apt at the moment. Where there is discord, may we bring harmony. Where there is error, may we bring truth. Where there is doubt, may we bring faith. And where there is despair, may we bring hope." Jim Pryor, her Secretary of State for Employment, was having none of it. "Oh, that was the most awful humbug," he insisted. "I mean, it was so alien to Margaret's belief about things. It was the most unutterable nonsense from that particular person." Malcolm Rifkin, who later became her Secretary of State for Scotland, agreed entirely. As he put it, Thatcher was contemptuous of pragmatism in any search for consensus. Under the British system, the Prime Minister's cabinet is composed of members of Parliament. There were plenty of moderate and liberal Tories, and Thatcher appointed several of them to various positions. She derisively referred to them as the wets, wet being a British pejorative meaning someone limp and ineffectual. In contrast to this were the Thatcherite dries on the right wing of the party. The tensions between the two wings played out within cabinet, and many of the wets constantly tested both her leadership and her patience. Thatcher's cabinet would never have a strong dry majority throughout her entire prime ministership. The Tories were traditionally the home of titled men born to privilege. Many of them had a sense of noblesse oblige, but few principles other than some vague idea of managing the government efficiently and effectively for the sake of the people. Implicit in this was the premise that they should be the ones managing it, as they had been born and raised to do. Answering to a grocer's daughter, such abominations were rarely seen outside of Leviticus. From their perspective, Thatcher's ideological views were simply the wrong path to take. As Thatcher anticipated, her monetarist approach to the economy caused a short-term worsening of economic conditions as a means of eventually resolving the problems of both rising unemployment and of inflation. "Yes, the medicine is harsh," she acknowledged, "but the patient requires it in order to live. We did not seek election and win in order to manage the decline of a great nation." As she also anticipated, by 1981, the worst economic news was beginning to pass, and Thatcher's political hand strengthened. That September, in a bid to assert her control of the government, Thatcher had a very public reshuffling of her cabinet in what became known as the purging of the wets. The men who were fired never recovered from their humiliation at the hands of that bloody woman. When interviewed about it years later, they came off like Disney cartoon villains in that the thickness of their British accents was in exact proportion to how entitled, embittered, and repulsive they appeared. "There wasn't a phalanx of these allegedly superior snobbish people," insisted Ian Gilmore, Baron Gilmore of Craigmillar. "It's a figment of Mrs. Thatcher's fevered imagination." Reagan and Thatcher had a largely synonymous view of those who she called our people, the hardworking homeowners who would form the basis of a thriving society. The two of them were largely interchangeable on domestic issues and made it a point of publicly saying so as much as possible. "As soon as I met Governor Reagan, I knew that we were of like mind, and manifestly so did he," Thatcher said. Nevertheless, her private opinion of said mind was not always positive. During one meeting in the Oval Office, for example, Reagan and Thatcher were discussing the highly contentious issue of apartheid. Reagan explained to Thatcher that the South Africans are whites, and they fought for us during the war. The blacks are black and are communist. After she left the meeting, she turned to her foreign secretary, pointed to her head regarding Reagan, and said, "Peter, there's nothing there." Yet despite their identical philosophy of governance, internationally, Thatcher and Reagan often had differing agendas. They both represented two different countries, and the two countries were sometimes rivalrous of one another. It was in 1982 that Thatcher's prime ministership had its ultimate test. The idiosyncratic Ayn Rand had been opposed to a female president due to her views on gender roles. "It is not to a woman's personal interest to rule man," she insisted. "It puts her in a very unhappy position. I don't believe any good woman would want that position." Though her novels were all defined by powerful, self-assured female characters, Rand had one very specific reservation about one of the Oval Office. "A commander-in-chief of the army? A woman? I think it's unspeakable." In the United Kingdom, it is the monarch who is technically commander-in-chief. One can only guess what Rand's reaction would have been when Margaret Thatcher was suddenly thrust into the role of leading the British military less than 1 month after Rand died. On April 2nd, 1982, Argentina invaded the nearby Falkland Islands, a loyal British colony for over a century. The Thatcher government had withdrawn HMS Endurance from the area a few months prior, despite the warnings of former Labour Prime Minister and former Foreign Secretary Jim Callaghan. This retreat led the Argentinian junta to believe that Great Britain would be either unwilling or unable to reclaim the islands if they are returned to Argentine rule after roughly 150 years. It was Thatcher's Foreign Secretary Lord Carrington who took the fall for the crisis, resigning his position for his inability to foresee Argentina's desire to exploit what they perceived as British weakness. If Thatcher couldn't bear to see Britain in decline, this was her opportunity to demonstrate that there was still life yet in her beloved country. Everything was now on the line, including Thatcher's government and Great Britain's dignity itself. She decided to send a task force to secure the islands. They were so far away that it would take British forces weeks to get there. In the interim, President Reagan dispatched his feisty Secretary of State Al Haig to Number 10 in hopes of, unofficially, mediating a diplomatic solution of some sort. Haig suggested a compromise, with the Argentine forces withdrawing in order to give way to British administration under some to-be-determined international authority. Thatcher was aghast. There could be as much diplomacy as anyone would like, but only once the aggression had been reversed and the status quo returned. Interim authority? To do what? I beg you to remember that in 1938, Neville Chamberlain sat at this same table discussing an arrangement which sounds very much like the one you're asking me to accept, and were I to do so, I would be censured in the House of Commons, and properly so. Britain simply will not reward aggression. That is the lesson of 1938. Soon a war zone was declared around the Falklands. Despite the enormous difficulties in fighting so far away from the United Kingdom and so close to Argentina, British troops made strong headway. On April 25th, Secretary of Defense John Nott stood alongside Thatcher on Downing Street to announce that they had successfully taken one of the islands after limited Argentine resistance and with no British casualties. He then read a message from the commander of the operation. "Be pleased to inform Her Majesty that the White Ensign flies alongside the Union Jack in South Georgia. God save the Queen." When reporters began to shout further questions, Thatcher quickly put a stop to it. "Just rejoice at that news and congratulate our forces in the Marines," she snapped. "Rejoice!" Journalists proceeded to criticize her for years for what they described as her triumphalism. Thatcher was similarly criticized for deciding to sink Argentina ship General Belgrano a week later, killing over 300 troops aboard in the process. The ship was technically outside the declared maritime exclusion zone, within which the British had declared any vessels to be fair targets. Thatcher knew that ships were perfectly capable of turning around and, in the view of the Foreign Office, if it hadn't wanted to be sunk, it shouldn't have been there. A peaceful resolution to the conflict was veering on impossible. Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet, as Thatcher later put it, was this country's staunch true friend in our time of need when Argentina seized the Falkland Islands, offering the use of his ports as well as crucial intelligence and logistical operations. Thanks in part to his support, earning him Thatcher's loyalty long after everyone else had repudiated him, by the end of May, the British were clearly on their way toward accomplishing their goals. Nevertheless, Reagan again tried calling to de-escalate the situation on May 31st, and Thatcher was again having none of it. As the President of the United States kept trying to interject with Margaret, but Margaret, Thatcher tore him a new one. "This is democracy and our island," she insisted, "and the very worst thing for democracy would be if we failed now. I didn't lose some of my finest ships and some of my finest lives to leave quietly under a ceasefire. How would the President feel supposing Alaska were invaded?" Indeed, Al Haig's successor as Secretary of State, George Shultz, later wrote that President Reagan was getting a little fed up with her imperious attitude on the matter, the exact term that had been used by the U.S. Embassy in 1975 to describe Thatcher's approach. 2 weeks later, the Argentinian forces surrendered and British control of the Falkland Islands was restored. In 1976, the Sex Pistols had topped the UK charts by insisting that there was no future in England's dreaming. Thatcher demonstrated otherwise. with an unambiguous victory that many Britons hadn't seen in their lifetimes. That, with the combination of an economy in upswing, gave Thatcher an enormous parliamentary victory the following year. The Conservatives gained 58 more seats, while Labour was reduced to 209, their worst result since 1935. Thatcher was no longer Heath's token female or transitional figure, but clearly an established government leader in her own right. It was only a few months after Thatcher's electoral landslide that Reagan stabbed her in the back, and hard. Grenada is a small island nation off the coast of Venezuela with a population of about 90,000 people. Despite a 1979 communist coup, Grenada nevertheless remained a member of the British Commonwealth with Queen Elizabeth II as head of state. Questions arose when American naval vessels were spotted near Grenada in late 1983. On October 24, 1983, Thatcher's right-hand man Geoffrey Howe addressed these concerns on the floor of Parliament. Howe insisted that there was no reason to think there would be any United States intervention in Grenada. He claimed and believed that the Reagan and Thatcher administrations were in close contact and that Thatcher's government would be given fair warning if matters were to turn militarily. What Howe didn't know was that President Reagan had already approved an invasion of Grenada by the United States 2 days earlier and that he chose to keep the matter from Thatcher. Worse, he intentionally misled her, if not downright lied to her. "I didn't want her to say no," Reagan later admitted. Thatcher was completely humiliated when the United States subsequently invaded in order to liberate the island nation. She had consistently trumpeted the newly rekindled special relationship between Great Britain and the United States. Now it was obvious that she had either been lied to or, at the very least, not bothered to have been consulted or even notified. A photographer caught the exact moment when a startled Reagan was told that Thatcher was on the phone as he was meeting with congressional leaders about the invasion of Grenada. As Reagan went to take the call, the politicians in the other room could hear him desperately trying to get in a word edgewise. "Margaret, but Margaret." At one point, he held the phone away from his ear, grinning the whole time at her feistiness. "Isn't she great?" Reagan said after the call ended. "She'll get over it." Not long after that, Reagan called Thatcher to apologize. "If I were there, Margaret," he said quickly, "I'd throw my hat in the door before I came in," meaning to see if the coast was clear in order to enter. "There's no need to do that," she replied, waiting to hear what he had to say for himself. The president began spouting nonsense about not telling her because he was concerned there would be a leak, as if a day's notice would have changed things in Grenada very much, telling her in classic political jargon that, "We regret very much the embarrassment that's been caused to you." There was little Thatcher could do other than accept his explanation. Her thoughts must have turned to World War II's Yalta Conference, when her idol Winston Churchill had to sit impotently by as FDR developed a demented bromance with the man that they both called Uncle Joe Stalin. Unlike in the United States, the British Prime Minister has to go down to the floor of Parliament and face questions from the opposition. And this time, Labour had Thatcher due to rights. "I must return to this debate in the House," she told Reagan. "It's a bit tricky." "Well, all right," Reagan replied. "Go get him. Eat him alive." Thatcher now had to answer what she knew, when she knew it, and why on earth Geoffrey Howe had said the exact opposite mere days prior. It wasn't humming lessons that she needed, but tap dancing lessons in order to dodge the questions she received. Thatcher did the best she could, and the situation eventually boiled over. Reagan was quite right. Thatcher did eventually get over it, but she remained painfully aware of Great Britain's relative powerlessness as compared to the United States. No matter how special the relationship was or seemed, it was the United States that was the superpower and leader of the free world, and not her beloved United Kingdom. A couple of months later, about a week before Christmas of 1983, the IRA successfully planted a car bomb outside London's world-famous Harrods department store. The area failed to get evacuated, even though the IRA had called in the threat. 6 people were killed and a dozen more injured as the bomb damaged 5 floors of the store, showering Brompton Road in glass and debris. A few days later, a defiant Dennis Thatcher went shopping there for presents. "It wasn't as crowded as it normally is," he confessed, "but no damned Irishman is going to stop me going there." The following year, Dennis almost had to eat his words. In mid-October 1984, Dennis was staying with Margaret and many other Tory luminaries at Brighton's Grand Hotel for a Conservative Party conference. By then, Thatcher had a well-established reputation for how little sleep she needed. Government apparatchiks who tried to overwhelm her by handing over voluminous documents at the last possible moment invariably found them returned in the morning full of her underlined, significant approval and squiggles for things that needed reworking. At approximately 3 a.m. on the morning of October 12th, a few minutes after she finished editing her speech, Thatcher heard a loud thud followed by a different sound. She immediately knew it was a bomb and only learned later that the second noise was that of a falling chimney making its way through several floors. Thatcher was safe in her hotel sitting room but had narrowly escaped serious harm. "The glass had come in," she later recalled, "which would have been very nasty had one been in the bathroom at that time. 5 people were killed and a few dozen injured, some very seriously, but none of them were the main targets of the bombing." The following day, the Irish Republican Army took credit in a ruthlessly cold-blooded statement. "Today we were unlucky, but remember, we will only have to be lucky once. You will have to be lucky always." The conference went on as planned. 9 days later, President Reagan took part in his second and final debate against the Democratic nominee, Jimmy Carter's Vice President Walter Mondale. The first debate had gone poorly for Reagan, who nevertheless maintained a massive lead in the polls due to a surging economy and his unflagging optimism. Yet Reagan's age had been a factor in 1976 and 1980, and now his age seemed to have visibly affected his performance. The moderator addressed this issue head-on.